Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore. This week, we have with us as our special guest, Dr. Low Ka Sing of Sogang University in Korea. Ka Sing is a fellow historian and assistant professor at Sogang's Institute for East Asian Studies. He also used to be a history teacher in Singapore, and he has written and edited 5 books, including, most prominently, Squatters into Citizens, the 1961 Bukit Ho Swee Fire and the Making of Modern Singapore, which was published by NUS Press in 2013. Welcome to the show, Ka Sing.
Hi, PJ. It's good to be here. Hi, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be on History of Singapore.
It's great to have you. So, let's start with you telling our listeners about your work. What do you research and write on?
I always introduce myself as a social historian. And by that, I mean I basically study the lives, experiences, historically of social groups or people in general in Singapore, in Southeast Asia. Sometimes this kind of history is also called history from below or people's history. The main idea here is to look at those small little histories that often get ignored when historians or public figures talk about the mainstream or dominant histories of any place or any country or nation.
Why are these important? Perhaps you could tell our listeners why these small histories are important to our understanding of the past.
I guess a lot of scholarship has shown the original impetus being in European history, American history, that the experiences and lives of the ordinary people are very much differ from the dominant narratives they are told in the history textbooks, in the museums, in the newspapers, and so on. There are different narratives that come out of this study of what I call the small histories or people's histories of Singapore. And that's something I have done most recently the Bukit Ho Swee Fire book, as well as in previously other histories of, for example, leprosy in Singapore and Malaya, of mental illness in Singapore and Malaya. And in all of these, the focus has been more on people's experiences. So these experiences often differ from what official statements say about the impact of certain policies or certain institutions.
And why do they often differ? Can you give us an example maybe of an instance where the official position or the official narrative on something like, public health is different from how people experience public health and why that's important?
Certainly. I think the basic reason for the difference is people are diverse and people have their own perspectives. They have a certain regime or routines of life every day. Living and when governments or experts in medicine interject and they implement certain new policies or reforms in public health or housing, it kind of clashes with people's way of life. And not all the social groups in a society respond the same way as the official narrative would state. So, for example, the much lauded Singapore stories narrative about our move from kampung housing or slums and squatter areas into public housing, which is supposed to be the modern form of housing, superior, clean, was not true for all people. One of the things I found actually was that for many of the people who first moved into one-room emergency flats built by the HDB and SIT in the 50s and 60s, those housing was not very different from living in a slum area in Chinatown or a squatter area in a kampung in the margins of the city. So there was not much of a difference. Not as what the housing planners and the public officials would say.
So this reminds me of something you mentioned at our Ask Me Anything on Reddit back in September. Right. When one Redditor asked if there were any fun facts to share about Singapore's history that are not widely known, and you replied, quote, "Pigs and toilets in the kampongs. Don't take too long to do your business. They are waiting."
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
This was kind of a joke that my interviewees shared with me. You know, their own experiences of having a pig wait outside the toilet they were using in the morning. But I think if you look at the ecology of the kampong and the lack of a state-built or modern sewage disposal system, these toilets were very different from the toilets that we have today, which is based on the use of water to dispose. And pigs were there. They were not fenced up in a enclosed area, and that was something that many public health officials and SIT HDB planners were very worried about, that pigs were just roaming and living together with human beings. But if you put two and two together, you see that there was a reason why the pigs were roaming and why the toilets were there that they could access. So in a way, this was a kind of a system that developed at the ground level that people used, which was beneficial to them. So they managed to feed the pigs. Of course, they didn't just feed the pigs with what was in the toilet, but there was a way to feed the pigs in a very inexpensive manner. And there was also a way to clear the human waste that was produced. You know, it was a big population living in the kampongs, very often congested housing, so a lot of human waste as well.
I think that the fact that this is regarded as a fact that isn't widely known, when actually this is still a form of existence for many, many people in rural parts of the world. But for Singapore, the fact that this was only 50 years ago and now isn't widely known illustrates how life is very different for Singaporeans today from just a generation or two ago. And especially our disconnect from our rural past. You know, you can still see what Chinatown is like. The buildings still are there. You can visualize the cubicles because you can still translate in some way the equivalent of the urban experience. But rural Singapore, the kampongs which the majority of Singaporeans lived in, you know, which ring the city area, they're almost totally gone. So I think a lot of our listeners will want to know what really was life like for residents of those kampongs in the in the 50s and 60s.
I think one of the joys of doing the research on the Bukit Ho Swee fire was trying to penetrate that history and try to map out the intimate details of people's everyday experiences and lives in the kampong. Well, first of all, the kampongs were not really rural. I mean, if you talk about rural, that would be places like Yio Chu Kang or Choa Chu Kang, and that would be a very different way of life in these kampongs, like Bukit Ho Swee, which were in or near the fringes of the city area. And they could not escape the economy and the politics of the city as such. So they were straddling, I suppose, the rural and the urban way of life. So, for example, they were still rearing pigs, growing some vegetables. So that was part of the kampong-based economy, which allowed them to have some kind of self-sufficient agriculture and rearing of livestock to get by. On the other hand, they were also involved in such trades like hawking. Some of them also worked in the city itself, in the shipyards, or in the British families in the bases of Singapore. Some of them worked in shops as assistants. So there were a variety of jobs that the kampong, and pretty much it was a dynamic group of people who were not really isolated from the economy of Singapore, very much tied to this economy and in some ways actually contributing to the functioning of this economy.
Right. So you're saying that these are kind of like, they functioned as sort of suburbs or commuter suburbs, because they were also connected to the city via public transport. There were buses, mosquito buses, and things like that. But at the same time, they also had a rural way of life, as opposed to Yio Chu Kang, which would have entirely been cut off.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you plot the location of these kampongs in the urban area, you find that they fan out from the main roads from the central area, the Chinatown area, because they left for to look for housing that was more spacious for their families, that could not be found in the shop houses of Chinatown. And yet, they needed to be close to the main roads, because that's where they would travel back to the central area where the jobs, or even some of their families, friends and relatives were staying.
Okay. But take us through, like, what does it mean to live in one of these places? For example, access to education, to healthcare, you know, what options were available for someone who lived in one of these semi-quasi-rural kampongs?
Depending on what kind of services you are looking at, but generally I would say in the 50s, the kampong dwellers had a considerable amount of autonomy from services provided by the state. So there were, in the kampong, services provided by the community. Whether it is the kampong community or the Chinese community at large, you know, they would build schools, primary schools, or occasionally one or two secondary schools, for example, in Bukit Ho Swee. So what they didn't have was a very strong connection with the state. Right. The fact that they lived in the kampong meant that this was housing that was built by private contractors, very basic housing made of wood and attap, so quite vulnerable to fire. There wasn't much sanitation, sewage disposal, or even water supply. I mean, they got the water supply, especially when the city council began to provide public standpipes. But by and large, this was a semi-autonomous community. Having said that, over the course of the 50s, as the franchise for Singapore expanded and the political parties, especially the PAP, began to penetrate into the lower classes, the working classes of the Chinese community, you'll find that more and more the kampong dwellers began to participate in some of these services provided by the state. And the best example of these was the volunteer firefighting squads that were established in the kampong to watch out for fires and snuff them out.
Right.
And these squads were partly independent in the sense that the manpower for the squads was drawn from people in the community. The young men would volunteer their services partly because they had time. Or else they would be idling around.
Right.
Because
unemployment,
a lot of underemployment.
Yeah. And the equipment, was that also contributed?
That's right. So a lot of the equipment was, these were very basic equipment, like things to pull down the attap roofs when they were on fire. These were provided by the fire department and the city council.
Okay.
So that's where you begin to see the state bringing its services, some of it, into the firefighting kind of community-based services that existed at the kampong level. But having said that, I would say also, by and large, there wasn't enough state intervention and support given to the kampongs. That's why they continued to burn.
Right.
And that's why Bukit Ho Swee happened. Right. Whereas a lot of the state resources were given to not making the kampong safe or sanitary, but basically, the British colonial government wanted to get rid of the kampongs in the city area. And much more effort and resource was given to building what the British considered low-cost flats.
Right.
That were being built by the Singapore Improvement Trust
right.
For the working class population.
Such as where we are now in Tiong Bahru.
Exactly, that's right. And these were never working class, low-cost housing, only in the eyes of the British.
Yeah. I'm very interested in what you're saying about autonomy. Because one common lament of Singaporeans, older Singaporeans, is how we've lost this kampung spirit. But it suggests that the kampung spirit also developed because of an absence of the state, in that because there was no state intervention in critical areas, because we had to do things on our own, therefore we developed this local spirit of people having to look out for each other. So it seems to me that when people lament the kampung spirit, they're also lamenting a certain loss of autonomy. Would you agree with that?
To some extent, although I would also caution the kind of romanticization of the kampung spirit, which is a kind of nostalgia but doesn't really try to reinvent or try to recapture the kampung spirit in a modern context. And that's very understandable, because the entire socio-economic basis for the kampung spirit has vanished. The reason why it emerged in the first place in the 50s and earlier was because of need. Because people need to help one another, because they had there was no reliable fire service that would put out a fire, and they needed to do that themselves.
Right.
It was also organized by certain groups. For example, the political parties organized some of these firefighting squads. The state also organized them. So they didn't exist as something that on its own within the community itself. And very much today, it would be very hard to replicate that kind of kampung spirit, because the state is so much involved in planning for and providing for people's housings and other aspects of life.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Phuket Ho Swee fire. Before the break, we were talking about the social history of the kampongs in Singapore in the 1950s. Now, Ka Seng, one of your books is on the Phuket Ho Swee fire, and this actually builds on what you've been talking about before, about the provision of services in Singapore and the gradual intervention of the state. And the Phuket Ho Swee fire is also, it also intersects in Singapore's political history in a very interesting way, because it happened just a few days after Tunku Abdul Rahman made his famous speech at the Singapore Press Club in 1961 that signaled he was willing to merge the Federation of Singapore and Borneo, British Borneo, to create Malaysia. But at the time, among the general public, the Tunku speech ended up being overlooked somewhat because the fire then broke out a day or two later. But your work has shown that its implications go way beyond just making us forget about the Tunku speech, that there are far greater, far more subtle implications about the fire, and as your book title says, turning squatters into citizens. So could you tell us more about what your research on the fire has uncovered?
Yeah, the thing, of course, about the merger with Malaysia was that, for Singapore at least, it failed. But what happened a few days later on with the Phuket Ho Swee fire, that was very much a history of success and achievement for the Housing and Development Board, and more generally for the PAP government. In the book, I characterize the fire as a turning point in the history of Singapore in the 60s. In fact, one of the big events in the 60s which changed the shape of Singapore, not just the physical landscape, which was now going to be replacing the congested and insanitary kampongs with what would then be considered high-rise and very standardized blocks of emergency housing in Phuket Ho Swee and around the area, progressively towards Chinatown in the years to come after the fire itself. So what the fire did was to tip the struggle, the balance of this struggle between the kampung housing and modern housing, which is high-rise slab blocks of apartments that were being built by the SIT originally and later on the HDB, towards the modern housing. And this is when you can begin to see that slowly, after the Bukit Ho Swee fire, you find that kampung housing will be on the retreat, and high-rise housing would become the dominant form of housing increasingly. First in the kampung areas, and then in the central area itself, when the slums, the shop houses of Chinatown will be cleared, and in many cases replaced by HDB flats as well. What the fire did was remarkable in creating a state of emergency. And this is something that is very unique in the history of Singapore, because there had been great fires before in the 1950s in Singapore. And what usually happens after a fire was people rebuild their homes and went back with their lives as previously. What was different about the Bukit Ho Swee fire was that on a much larger scale than the British did previously in the 50s, the PAP would now take a leading role in acquiring the fire site, fencing it off so that the squatters do not come back to rebuild the wooden housing on the fire site. And then very quickly, within the space of a year, built the emergency flats on the fire site, as well as on nearby areas that also acquired by the government. So the state really had a big role to play in transforming Bukit Ho Swee after the fire. And what this did, of course, when you have multi-story blocks of apartments, if you can house a lot more people in the same size, the same area of land than previously in a kampung, which was quite flat. So that means you could clear nearby kampungs as well. This began the clearing of what was called the Black Belt in Singapore city, the belt of kampungs that were considered undesirable, and replacing them gradually with public housing flats.
Right.
So this is where the struggle began to be won. And once you could clear the margin, you could then clear Chinatown, because no one else is going to leave Chinatown. There's a bigger population who actually live in Chinatown, in the central area. And the only way was, you can't move them outside of the city, that would be too far from their workplace. So you needed to clear the kampongs first before you could clear the central area and the slums in the Chinatown area.
As your book title suggests, squatters into citizens. This has transformed the relationship. We talked earlier before the break about autonomy, but you've suggested in your work that this has also transformed the relationship of the residents with the state. Mm. Well, how so?
So what I did with the study of the Bukit Ho Swee fire then kind of coincides with the scholarship, which is not new, which is not something that I created, but the scholarship that housing is not just about shelter, but the development of public housing in Singapore is very much tied to national development and economic development of Singapore as a whole. So when the kampung dwellers or the fire victims move into public housing on a permanent basis, they began to adopt a way of life which is drastically different from what they had done before. So for example, pigs and wooden toilets were no longer possible. And this also meant that it had an economic impact. Rent had to be paid in the flats on a regular basis. So you can't just wait for part-time employment or casual employment in order to pay the rent. It had to be paid, and the HDB was going to press you to pay the rent every month. And subsequent to that, from 1968 onwards, when the government began to allow the use of CPF savings to pay for the ownership, the purchase of HDB flats, it also became important, therefore, to have a full-time permanent job in order to continuously contribute to the CPF and pay for the purchase of the flats over long-term installments. So from that perspective, the CPF, and coupled with the public housing project, was immensely successful in changing how people looked at their life and the importance of work, the kind of work that they were going to do, and the perspective of housing as well. Housing has transformed so much, and not just in terms of the kind of housing, the physical state of housing, but the importance that Singaporeans attach to housing. Buying a flat is one of the rituals that most Singaporeans go through, which is very different from the past, when Singaporeans basically do not care very much about the kind of housing that they were living in, as long as it was large enough for their family, or as long as it was relatively close to their workplace or to their family and friends.
I see, that's really interesting. So you're saying that before this is sort of an inflection point where before this, you have Singaporeans could live off the land in a almost autonomous fashion. They didn't have to be participants in the economy, in the state. They could have pigs, they could grow vegetables. But once you get into HDB housing, it's not just the flat, but it's a whole different lifestyle that comes with it. You have to take part in the modern economy. You have to be plugged into, you know, rent payment, tax payments, and you have to, you can't have any sort of independence from the state. So that's what you meant by squatters to citizens.
I tried to get the argument into the title of the book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So this is something that I guess people don't really think about when it comes to housing. You know, it transforms your entire lifestyle, your family's lifestyle. It transforms your role in the economy. It introduces all sorts of new responsibilities to you as a person that you have to do. Otherwise, you lose the roof over your head. Okay,
yeah, I suppose that is the main argument I used. But the social history also approach also plays out certain exceptions or certain fragments of history that differ from this main thesis. So what I also found was that housing did not transform all Singaporeans the same way. There were people, for example, especially the poorest families who could not afford to purchase a HDB flat, especially those who lived in rented one-room emergency flats, who could not keep up with the payments. And these were families which struggled, not just financially, but also socially, being left out, in a sense, in the economic success story of Singapore and most Singaporeans. And you find that a lot of that in Bukit Ho Swee itself. You find that as new estates were built subsequent to Bukit Ho Swee, new towns in Queenstown completed, and then Toa Payoh, and then Woodlands, and then other housing estates were built as well, that Bukit Ho Swee sort of reverted from being an icon of modernity in the 1960s to becoming backward again compared to the other estates, which were newer, brighter, and more glamorous to live in. So there continued to be a kind of underclass of poorer families who were living in Bukit Ho Swee throughout the 1970s and 1980s.
So what happens to these families if they find that they cannot... they have no choice but to live in HDB because there's no other option. Mm. So what happens to them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that was one of the things I tried to point out in the book, which is to show a change in these Singaporeans' mindset. I mean, you can be critical of kampong dwellers about being foolish to live in such poor and dirty housing. But one of the things I found about the kampong dwellers was that they were optimistic about the future, about themselves and their children, that they would have a future which was better than the present. And in that sense, they were modern. They believe in improvement. The fact that they moved out, many of them moved out from Chinatown, from the central area, to the kampongs was a sign, the Chinese population, especially historically, lived in the central area. They were very reluctant to move. But the fact that they moved out to places like Phuket Ho Swee or Bugis, showed this willingness to change, to move to a new environment. Take into consideration the fact that many of these kampongs were built on disused cemeteries. And usually, the Chinese tradition is to separate the living and the dead. The living would live in the valleys and the dead would be buried in the hills. Mm-hmm. But Phuket Ho Swee, as the name suggests, was a hill. And many of the kampongs were built on hills. So there's a new Chinese mindset that it was okay to live on the hills together with the graves. So this was a change among the mindset of the Chinese community after the Second World War, and it's a sign of the optimism that they had, the confidence that they had, that by leaving the central area and going to the kampongs, they would get a new way of life, a better standard of living for themselves and their children. So what happened later on when the poorest Singaporeans were living in the HDB flats, the one-room rented housing in Phuket Ho Swee and other old estates of Singapore, was this optimism began to be eroded, right? When you remain poor, as the country grew rich and other Singaporean families got better off, you lost this belief in improvement. You lost this self-confidence. And you began to believe that the poverty that you had was perpetual. You thought that there was no longer any hope that life would be better for you or even your children. And so you can see some of these family tensions playing out. And there's a sociologist, a social worker who has written about the street children of Phuket Ho Swee in the 1980s, children who were very much marginalized. And you know, they drop out of school or they perform badly in school, or they got into trouble with the law, with authority. What was it that one of my interviewees told me that, sorry to say this on radio, but he said in Hokkien that as one of those street children, when they see the policeman, right, he thought, you know, kuan liao du lan, right? He would be so pissed off to see someone from authority. So they would do certain socially kind of deviant things, right, on the basketball court. If someone was playing basketball, they would start to play football, you know, disrupt the game.
Right.
So the point here is to put a new spin to the Singapore story, to show that not everyone followed that progress from third world to first. Maybe most did, and most benefited from that change in housing to public housing. But there was always a small minority, but important minority, that lagged behind. And their story also needs to be told in the research on Singapore history.
That's very interesting. So the HDB breeded its own sort of marginalization and underclass. I'm very interested in what you're saying about the Singapore story. Can you tell us more about how your research differs from what the official Singapore story says about Phuket Ho Swee, about the narrative of development, about the HDB?
In a sense that the Phuket Ho Swee fire was a turning point. Usually in the Singapore story, the fire is seen as a big disaster, a humanitarian disaster, but also as a kind of blessing in disguise. Where after the fire, like the phoenix rising from the ashes, that the people of Phuket Ho Swee was transformed into a community living in clean, modern and safe housing. So what the research tried to show is that there was also economic and social implications of the fire in changing how people thought about the state and their relationship with the state. After the fire, they became a lot more integrated into the structures of the state, and their way of life, their employment, their work also changed accordingly as well. So it wasn't just a disaster or a blessing in disguise. It was very much a catalyst for change. The fire was a catalyst for change.
Okay, so talk about the Singapore story. Now, you've been a history teacher in Singapore, and you wrote the textbook for Sec 3 history, but not the textbook for Singapore history.
Yeah.
Well, what's the difference?
The Sec 3 history textbook was on Southeast Asia, right, and covered mostly the colonial history of Southeast Asia up till the decolonization and the creation of nation states. Whereas Sec 2 history, Sec 1, Sec 2 history is really on Singapore's history as well as Singapore's earlier historical connections with Asian civilizations.
Okay. So how do you feel about, you know, and this is a common question I think that also arose on our Reddit AMA, how do you feel about how history is taught in our schools today?
Well, there has been some changes in some ways in the teaching of history. There is now a greater focus on the use of primary sources and how to analyze and compare the historical sources. There's also been a greater focus on group work and project work. And so these are all good things. The main problem is that the teaching of history is still very much geared towards results. So very often the good intentions behind the curriculum are not achieved. Instead of teaching students how to grapple with competing historical sources like historians do, and one of the main aims of the history curriculum in Singapore is to get students to think and work like historians. Because of the focus on examinations, very often teachers end up teaching students how to mechanically analyze or use or talk about sources as if they were a part of the examination system. So very much, I think we still need to work on that in terms of getting students to think like historians, right, to grapple with different sources. And therefore to learn how to deal with different viewpoints in history. And you can only do that by lessening the emphasis on examinations and grades.
Right. And I suppose being more tolerant of different interpretations of the sources in the examinations. So if, because what I'm getting from I think I'm hearing is that the teacher will teach the student how to interpret the source, but you're supposed to interpret it a certain way to come out a certain answer, rather than saying, you know, rather than accepting that student could look at the source, come up with an answer that is completely different from what he or she, what the teacher expects, and then giving credit to the student if they can then justify that answer.
Yeah, I mean, there are two issues here. One is that because of the focus on exams, the approach used by teachers and students is really quite technical.
Right.
So it's a number of steps that students can use in order to ace the subject. Right. And that's not new. You know, teachers have always taught students that way. And the other one is, of course, the curriculum itself and how far it encourages students to come to their own conclusion. And in the secondary two textbook on the history of Singapore, it's still very much a singular history of Singapore progressing from a port settlement to a modern nation state. And there isn't very much room for maneuver. If the textbook doesn't advocate for diverse viewpoints, then teachers will not teach it. Because this will not be examined at the national level.
And teachers' pay is also linked to KPIs and things like that, right? So they have to teach it if they want to get paid, basically, right?
Yeah, bonuses, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask this. I know a lot of people are going to want to know. It's a common conspiracy theory that the Bukit Ho Swee fire was started by the government. What do you think?
Lots of rumors about that. Even on the day of the fire itself, people were telling reporters that I saw this heartless person or to throw burning material onto the rooftops of a particular house, not very far from where we are.
So that was reported in the newspapers?
It was reported in both the English and Chinese newspapers. And subsequently, there was a trail of newspaper reports about the progress of the police investigations, and someone was actually hauled in for questioning but then released. And then, at some point within a year of the fire, those rumors, those reports ended. Right now, we still do not know how the fire started. But I think, regardless of who was responsible or what was responsible for the fire, the fire occurred not as accidents or because people were negligent. I mean, yes, they were negligent about their housing, about the use of fire in the kampong area. But the historical context was such that fires happen easily. This was the most combustible and vulnerable part of Singapore city to fire, and yet there was no adequate water supply to these areas. There was no good road access into the interior of the kampongs where the fire would spread. So you find here in Bukit Ho Swee in Tiong Bahru, there are two main roads, Tiong Bahru Road and Havelock Road, which come from the central area. And fire engines had no problem getting to these places, but they couldn't get into the to the center areas of these settlements. And if you look at that and analyze that, you find that the responsibility very often falls on the state for not providing a safe infrastructure and living environment for the kampongs, which makes them vulnerable to fire.
Okay, I think we're out of time, but thank you, Ka Seng. This has been a really interesting discussion, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, PJ. It's been a real pleasure to be on the show.
You're very welcome. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. And if you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. See you next week.